You're welcome. Our next case, as parties are approaching, is A23-0351, the State of Minnesota versus Chad Buckley. As all parties are aware, the appellant counsel will have 15 minutes for his argument in chief, respondent will have 15 minutes for her argument, and finally the appellant will have 5 minutes for rebuttal. Whenever you're ready, just approach the microphone, adjust it to your level, and please tell us who you are in a loud, clear voice. Thank you.
Good morning. May it please the court, counsel. My name is Joseph McInnes. I'm an assistant public defender, and I represent Chad Buckley. A probable cause determination requires factual information. A warrant affidavit must provide the magistrate with sufficient factual information to make an independent determination of probable cause. In this case, the warrant affidavit lacked probable cause for three broad reasons. First, it relied on conclusory statements from SB and a known but anonymous informant who was described as a neighbor in the affidavit. in addition, there was an issue that is in the facts of the affidavit. There is reflected that the information that the affiant acted on was stale. We had basically a week pass from the alleged accusations that are included in the affidavit to the actual submission and signing of the search warrant. And lastly, we have the issue of the reliability of the neighbor informant who was the district court did not properly even apply the test that the district court should have applied to.
You mean on the neighbor?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes.
You know, are the conclusory statements, does that include the video and the text messages?
Yeah, it does, and the I think
they seem pretty specific to me. I mean, you know, there's a text of a threatening message. There's a video of your client, you know, next to a gun. I mean, why is that not enough?
So I think the you know, looking at the actual what the actual affidavit states, it does. I think it leads to that impression that that is a threatening message, that there's an entire clear depiction of a gun, but when we drill down on the actual words of the affidavit, it says SB made these allegations in her paperwork for the protective order. I received the video. I confirmed.
I viewed the video.
Right, yes.
I viewed the video and confirmed that the video showed a shotgun lying on the bed.
Correct.
Okay. What does that mean besides that the officer viewed the video and saw a shotgun lying on the bed?
Well, I think it means that the officer had to take some step in order to make that confirmation. The affidavit doesn't say, I viewed the video and I immediately recognized this to be
You take
a
issue with the word confirm. In context, it seems hard to me to read that as anything other than I looked at it and I saw a gun. This confirmation that that the officer had to do more somehow by I don't know what, like going on the internet and comparing like the picture with a picture of a gun. I mean, it just seems to really take a lot of issue with the word confirm, whereas in context I can't read that any other way than I viewed it and I saw a gun.
I think when we look at the broader, the broader record in this case, there is, the video of, the video is included in the record in terms of the trial exhibit one. And the video is it's not, it's not leading to this impression that I think that the affidavit might, that
the video doesn't show a gun.
The video shows a portion, the video shows a portion of what appears to be
a gun,
a rifle.
Okay.
We also know that there was several BB gun rifles in this residence. And
but it shows him next to it, right?
And he's it's not, not no. So that's another issue is that the video, as it's described in the affidavit, is that there's there's really a portion of the gun on a bed, but Mr. Buckley is not visible in that video.
And we're just looking at the four corners of the application.
Correct,
right?
Correct.
So regardless of what the record might show, you're saying it's not enough that your affiant viewed the video and confirmed the video showed a shotgun lying on the bed.
Correct.
That just is not enough because of the word confirmed in there? Or what more did the officer need to do if, in fact, the officer, if he had written, I viewed the video and I saw a shotgun lying on a bed, would that be enough?
I think that would be.
So it's just confirmed versus saw.
Yeah. I think it is. Yes, because there's this extra step that has to happen because it's only a portion of the gun, and because you have to take an extra step to make.
Well, there's no portion referenced in the affidavit.
Not in the affidavit.
And that's what we're looking at, right?
Correct. Okay. And so the affidavit, just the plain language of the affidavit is, I received the video, I viewed it, I confirmed that. There, that it was a gun there, and we don't have that confirmation. I went to our firearms instructor, or I talked to, the trap shooting high school coach or whatever, and confirmed that it was a gun and not a BB gun or something else. The other thing, if there's if the officer is immediately recognizing that it's a gun, then the officer would put that in the affidavit. I saw the video and I could immediately recognize that this was a gun. Or the officer, this is part of giving the judge the facts for the judge's independent determination. So, I saw a portion of a gun and it looks very similar to, a Winchester shotgun because of the style of the stock or something like that. I don't think that there has to be much more information, but there has to be something there, factual, for the magistrate to draw their own conclusion, and that's really the key, I think, that problem in this case is that we don't have that in this case. Move on to the other conclusory issue is with, I think there's a similar issue in terms of the sound of the gunshot. All we have is the conclusory description that the sound is a gunshot, but we don't have any, even the smallest fact, for the magistrate to make an independent judgment on that. So we don't have, it sounded like a firecracker, or I heard a loud pop, or anything along those lines to describe.
The search warrant affidavit contains statements from SB who also lived the residence, that 5 days before the warrant was signed, she heard appellant shooting a gun from the upstairs deck towards the road. I mean, how is that not? I mean, I understand your comments about the neighbors, but, you know, presumably, that seems to tie your client directly to the gunshots. So why is that also fails?
That also fails because we don't have, you know, we don't have a statement from SB saying, I saw him with, you know, I saw him with the gun and I, you know, I saw him on the deck or I even knew he was home. You know, I saw him come in and it was a couple hours later or.
Well, I mean, you know, wouldn't you, if she heard him, presumably she was there and presumably he was there because she heard him shooting a gun from the upstairs deck. So you're saying again, it's just, as Judge Smith was pointed out, you know, you're relying on confirmed the language here. What she needed to, the affidavit needed to say she saw him shooting the gun?
No, I'm not. I'm not saying that, but I'm saying that there needs to be, in terms of her designation of it as a gunshot, there needs to be facts for the magistrate to make that independent decision. So there needs to be something like, you know,
I'm a hunter and I've heard gunshots and that's a gunshot.
Yes, yes, just any shred any shred of factual information that could allow the magistrate to make an independent judgment. But what we have here are conclusions in each of these cases that prevent that. It's, you know, it's the immediate jump to designating it as a gunshot. And without the basis of knowledge or without, so there's no, I'm a hunter and I know what a gunshot sounds like. And there's no, I would argue enough of a firsthand, you know, this is not a detail rich firsthand observation.
It's, you know, what about, you know, do you agree that a defendant's past crimes can be considered as part of the totality of circumstances for determining whether PC exists?
Yes.
Okay. And he has some possession of, you know, he has some gun charges, right?
Yes, from 2004. He had the one.
Well, doesn't all of that seems to suggest grounds for a warrant. In addition to, which we haven't even talked about, you know, the death threats, which seem to be pretty severe.
Well, I would say that in terms of the prior conviction, we're talking about something that's 16 years before. So I think that's, you know, at a certain point, a prior conviction, I think, is too remote in time. And certainly that's pretty much, you know, double the time period that we would use in district court for determining whether it was relevant or not. So,
well, I mean, that's a trial.
Correct. But,
well, I mean, would you, your client was permanently barred from having a firearm. Would that be a fair statement?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes. And I think that is actually how that fact is used in the affidavit. The way I read the affidavit, I don't see that being used as to show some ongoing criminal activity or modus issue in terms of creating probable cause in the affidavit. And then in terms of the...
What about the staleness then, counsel? So how so a week? You know, I don't think we've said that's stale. I'm just going to say that.
I think in Ward there was a 3-day lapse. There's discussions in Gertie's v. State about like the factors that the court should consider in terms of staleness, in terms of, you know, is this object of enduring utility? Is there a market for this object? And can this object be moved in, you know, in inconspicuous manner? And so I think in terms of evaluating those, we know that there's, you know, a huge market for firearms in this country. And you know, this is something that can be put in a case and moved about in a inconspicuous way. So I think if we look at Gertie's and Ward and other cases, there is a foundation for saying that that this information was stale. And with going back to your Honor's question regarding the text messages, you know, I think the text messages, you know, which are part of the staleness argument, because the text messages end on December 9th, and those are concerning, but I think they reflect, first of all, there's no allegation or no, there's nothing in the text messages regarding gun violence or I'm going to shoot anyone or anything along those lines. And the other thing to consider in terms of this is that, you know, we do have the benefit of the entire record, and in that record, in terms of their case, their text messages between.
I mean, you know, one of the messages was he did not want to hurt anyone, but was not left much of a choice. I mean, that sounds like a threat to me.
I think that would be, that's a concerning statement, and I think it's, you know, this is all kind of unfolding in a situation where there's, you know, this is in the middle of a COVID lockdown, there's an eviction moratorium, and, you know, SB is, you know, there's ongoing discussions about what's going to happen to Mr. Buckley's ability to stay at the residence, and
right, this which would all seem to support the idea that he's, you know, at the end of his rope and something's going to happen. Well, anyway. All right. You will have 5 minutes for rebuttal.
Thank you.
Ms. McGinnis, thank you so much. We'll now hear from counsel from the respondent, please.
Good morning. May it please the court, counsel. My name is Heather Pippenhagen, and I am an assistant Dakota County attorney here on behalf of the state. A search warrant can be issued based on probable cause. In other words, when the totality of the circumstances establishes a substantial likelihood evidence of a crime will be found in the place to be searched. Again, probable cause, not beyond a reasonable doubt or any higher standard, simply probable cause, a substantial likelihood. In this case, the totality of the circumstances, as described in the warrant by the investigator, clearly established probable cause. And those circumstances are as follows. First of all, appellant lives in the upper level of SB's home. Appellant texted SB a video showing a gun laying on what she described as his bed, that SB heard appellant shooting a gun from the deck on the upper level of her home just a few days before the search warrant was obtained, that a neighbor in close proximity, and in the previous paragraph, directly behind SB, also confirmed that he had heard gunshots coming from SB's house on two different occasions, one approximately 2 weeks before, one less than a week before the warrant was obtained. The totality of all of these circumstances provide for any court to find a substantial likelihood there's a firearm in that house. I would like to focus.
Counsel, could I ask you about the video? And maybe I misheard you. We don't have a date, do we, with regard to the video, when the video was taken?
In the actual search warrant affidavit, I do not believe there is a date included, correct. So I would like to focus on really the main argument against this warrant, which is that the facts are simply conclusory statements I think that is really the primary flaw in this challenge is this repeated mischaracterization of the facts in this case as conclusory statements. And appellant does this really by going over all kinds of different ways in which the investigator could have been wrong, SB could have been wrong, or the neighbor could have been wrong. But that is not the same as the facts that were provided being conclusory statements. These are completely different concepts. For example, if the investigator would have said, based on all the information I gathered from all of the parties in this case, I believe there's a gun in the house, that would be a conclusory statement because the investigator isn't providing the reviewing magistrate with what are the facts that I have gathered. Or had the investigator, had SB said, I believe he has a gun in my house, but didn't tell the investigator why. Or if the neighbor said, I think somebody in that house has a gun, but didn't tell the investigator why. Those are conclusory statements. But in this case, the facts are all laid out in the affidavit. So they're not conclusory statements. So the case law that talks about the dangers of relying on conclusory statements does not at all apply to this search warrant. And by focusing, I think, on all of the ways each of these people could have been mistaken about what they directly saw or directly heard, it really kind of pushes the court to isolate individual pieces of information rather than looking at the whole picture, but also suggests much more of a standard than just probable cause, more like beyond a reasonable doubt. And it's also a hyper-technical. I think you saw that in appellant's argument. It's a very hyper-technical view of each specific word in that warrant, which the case law clearly says reviewing courts should not do. Could appellant be convicted of felon in possession of a firearm based on a video showing what appears to be a firearm on his bed? Probably not. But does that give a court probable cause to sign a warrant so the officers can see if there's a gun in that house? Yes, it does. And the same thing goes for SB's information about hearing him shooting a gun from the porch and a neighbor hearing gunshots coming from her house. Could he be convicted beyond a reasonable doubt of reckless discharge of a firearm based on that? Probably not. But does that add to the probable cause that there's a gun in that house and that he's possessing a gun in that house unlawfully? It does. So I think, again, I would just focus on the fact that what we're looking at is probable cause for the warrant. It's clearly established here. I know there was a lot of talk from appellant or some talk in argument about facts outside of the four corners of the warrant. And I think Judge Smith was careful to bring it back to what's in the warrant. And I would just remind the court that's what the issuing judge had to look at is the facts in that warrant and not anything else that's referenced. There's some other facts referenced in the brief. Also, I think somewhere in the brief it says this neighbor wasn't even willing to meet with the officer, only talked to him on the phone. That is certainly nothing that's in the warrant. I don't know if that was just a misinterpretation of the language. The language says SB provided the neighbor's phone number and address, and the officer then says, I spoke with the neighbor. There isn't any indication of how that conversation occurred. So based on all of that information that's available, there certainly was probable cause. I just want to touch very briefly on that staleness issue. I know appellant just talked about Ward and the concern about 3 days in Ward. I just want to point out that was a hotel room case, and 3 days is a valid concern when you're talking about a guest in a hotel room. And in that case, the court specifically referenced the danger of invading the privacy of the next guest in a hotel room because people are typically only there for short periods of time and aren't entrenched. So this is not that kind of a case. This is his residence. It's a firearm. That's something people usually keep for more than a few days. And there's no reason, certainly no facts, to think that he didn't still possess this firearm. There's multiple times where the gunshots are heard over a period of time. So no reason to think he just had it for a day. And therefore, I think the staleness challenge, even if this court addresses it when it wasn't specifically argued in the district court, I think that staleness challenge fails. Unless the court has any other questions, I just to keep you on schedule, I'm happy to forfeit the rest of my time.
Thank you. Thank you. Counsel for the appellant, you'll have the last word, sir.
So just to circle back to the issue in terms of the facts that the affiant provided in the affidavit, you know, here we don't have, we have this, and actually, you know, and if we look at Soto,
there were 6 months and 11 months, right? I seem to recall the staleness issue in Soto was, I mean, it was months going by, 6 months, 11 months.
Or, the portion of Soto I'm referring to is in terms of the conclusory statements.
Oh, I'm sorry.
And my apologies. And in that case, there was a very lengthy affidavit that the detective provided. The detective went through, you know, there's multiple CRIs in that case, and there was also, you know, he described that, you know, the sources for his belief that the defendant in that case was selling drugs on a wide scale or was a drug trafficker on a wide scale. But just because the affiant provides all information doesn't make that information sufficient. And what we need and what, you know, we can't, I don't think we can defer or use the deferential standard to make up for assumptions in the affidavit. And I think that's the point of Soto. And here we have these assumptions about, you know, basically the affiant saying, I confirmed it was a gun, but not giving the magistrate the factual information that's needed to make an independent determination. And in terms of SB and the neighbor, there's the conclusion that it was a gunshot, but there's not any factual information whatsoever to give to allow the magistrate to make that determination. So I think when we when we look at this in the context of Soto, the affiant in this case did describe the investigation. What the affidavit was missing was the factual information that the magistrate needed to make an independent determination. And just in terms of the deferential standard and being hyper-technical, I don't think that the Supreme Court in Soto or, you know, my arguments necessarily here are being hyper-technical. I think if we look at that deferential standard, I think in Harris is a good example of, like, how the Supreme Court used that deferential standard. And in that case, there's, you know, a terrible homicide in Minneapolis where it was in an apartment building, it was the neighbor who committed the murder. And so the police obtained, you know, firsthand information from two people who were with the victim on the night that it occurred and saw the neighbor come into the apartment. And then the police obtained the surveillance video of the suspect leaving with the victim's property. And in that case, Harris used the deferential standard to say, okay, you know, the affidavit left out, like, the time of the surveillance when he's leaving. But when you read it, all the facts together, it's obvious that he's in the building, he's coming into the apartment, and then he's leaving with this stuff. And they use the deferential standard to make that connection. So I think the deferential standard is much more narrow than I think what the respondent is suggesting. So, and I'm happy to entertain any other questions that the court may have.
I don't think we have any, but thank you very much. The matter is submitted. We will issue our decision within 90 days.
Thank you.
You're welcome.